ていう。
Okay. Whew, so with only 17 minutes late, we can start. Once again, sorry. I hope that at least now my brain has the tendency to be fully booted and we can continue talking about networks. So last time, what we did, we started with Gaussian mixture model. So for some of you, or I don't know about those that just listened to the recording, so for some this might have been really heavily math loaded, but I think that once again it is worth digging through these formula and to get a basic understanding about what is maximum likelihood, what is learning of a model, and so on and so on. And one remark with respect to the Gaussian mixture model. So what we used them for was for clustering, right? And the goal was if we had a point cloud which looked like this somewhere, features of whatever sort, I mean audio features, interests, texts converted to numbers, whatever, the goal was to fit some Gaussian mixture model to the whole scene and then say, okay, each Gaussian represents a cluster, right? And so we, with the help of these responsibilities, we could compute membership degrees in a certain sense, or in other words, probabilities that the respective Gaussian has generated the points. And that's another key feature in machine learning, at least with respect to generative models, that you think, that you make up a story of how the data, of how you think the data has been produced, and that's your model, right? And then when you have the story, the active generative story, what you do is you reverse the story and try to learn the parameters of your generative model back from the data. Yeah, so with maximum likelihood, for example. Yeah? And that's an idea that carries far into every corner of machine learning. However, last remark, if you have several of these models, right? So you have a set of parameters. What we have, this is P of X given theta. Yeah, this was the Gaussian mixture model. And the thetas were the parameters that we were after in view of learning, right? And if you have, instead of clustering, if you have a classification problem, yeah, let's assume this were the generative model of class one, yeah? So this represents class one. Now, this is a model for whole class one, yeah? So class one consists of several Gaussians, yeah? In clustering, each Gaussian corresponded to a cluster, but that's now a different story. When you use them for clustering, this is, let's say, class one. So all the points belong to class one. And so what we have here is that we have C1 here, and you might have the same thing, or at least an analogous thing, for points that belong to a different class, yeah? And let's say we have a different number of Gaussians here, and that's supposed to be class 2. And what you have here is P of X and theta, and these are naturally the parameters theta 1 that correspond to class 1, okay? And then you have theta 2, which correspond to class 2, right? Okay, then you can continue that story and learn Gaussian mixture models for, let's say, 5 classes or 10 classes. And if you want to use them for classification, if you have a new point, let's say a point that lies here, yeah, what you would do, you would say the class of your new point X is the argmax with respect to C, yeah, of P of X theta, and c, right? So you look at the probability or the likelihood, however you want to view that, of that point, of that geometric point here. So that has a very low probability because we're far away from the Gaussians. And the same point here has a comparatively high probability because it's close to one of these Gaussians. Yeah. So you would say, okay, if I were to decide which class this new point would belong to, I would choose class 2 because it fits this point better in a certain sense. Yeah. So that's what you do here. And what you actually do is, if these classes have the same prior probability, then you would just do that, okay? But you can have the case that the whole class 1 is less probable than the whole class 2 as a prior probability. So what you do is you compute the argmax, and you'd have something like that. So that's a prior probability of that class, okay? And that's how you would use Gaussian mixture models for classification, okay? And this carries on to, well, this is pretty general in terms of all generative models, right? So the these Gaussian mixture models are then generative model for the whole class, right? And so you can use them for classification. And generative, this term stems from the fact that if you model something with the help of a probability distribution, for example, then you can use that to sample points, right? So you can really execute the forward story and say, if I have this Gaussian mixture model, I can sample new points from that, as many as I like, yeah, just by sampling from a probability distribution. In that way, these things generate points. Yeah, and that was the whole story. Yeah, things generate points. And the contrast to a generative model would be a discriminative model. Yeah. So if you have the same situation with points, yeah, and you want to, say, learn the difference between the crosses and the dots, you can also use a support vector machine, for example. Yeah, support vector machines would just try to learn some discrimination surface that kind of distinguishes the balls from the crosses. Okay, and this would be totally sub-symbolic in a certain sense. So you would have an objective goal that you would try to optimize with the help of optimization techniques. In case of SVMs, it's constrained convex optimization, but you would not try to fit a generative model. Yeah? So you don't care about the story that generated the data. The only thing that you care of is the discrimination surface. Okay, good. So that was the final remarks with respect to Gaussian mixture models. And then we switched to our new chapter, and that's real-world networks and their properties and models. Okay, and what we saw was that social media offers us the chance to get away from laboratory biases by just observing people in their natural habitat, right? So by downloading, for example, network data or profile data that people make public about themselves, you can gain a lot of insights about the way people interact and the structure and properties of large networks, right? So the paradigm shift is that in traditional sociometry, we people regarded small networks in the order of magnitudes of hundreds of nodes, and now we have billions of nodes. And naturally, what you can see is that these are very hard to visualize, right? So we cannot easily make use of our eyes as structure identifying tools. But instead, what we're interested in is properties or classification axis statistical properties of these networks that tell us how they came about, how they were generated, what their structural properties is, and to a certain extent why these properties are as they are. Okay, and we said, okay, we look at general networks, meaning that we're not only restricted to social networks. Yeah, it is way more interesting to compare these social networks to the web or the internet. These are informational or technological networks, as well as biological networks, right? So the same techniques would apply to analyzing them, okay? And you could even go further and say, well, in terms of games, our first assignment was about, among other things, was about designing storyboards, okay? And storyboards are nothing but directed graphs, right? Tree-like in most cases, but in very many cases, they're graph-like. And if these become very complicated, you could as well employ techniques from network analysis here as well. Okay. And then we said, okay, what are these properties? And we began introducing some of them that you would be able to use in classifying these networks and characterizing them. And the most important ones are the ones that we would look at. Okay. And the first thing was mean average path length. And that was the measure that allowed us to kind of, yeah, well, quantify phenomena like these 6 degrees of separation. And we will see that small mean average path lengths are something that is not too hard to achieve, right? And in that regard, we speak of the small world effect in the sense of, 6 degrees of separation if the mean average path length as a function of the number of nodes goes as the logarithm of this number of nodes, okay? So for 10 to the 6 or 10 to the 8, we'd have path length in the order of magnitude of 6 or 8 or whatever, yeah? So notwithstanding any constants, yeah? So the asymptotic behavior is it goes as log n, and if it goes as log n, we'll speak of a small world effect. And that's not to be confused with Watts and Strogatz's small world model, which we will come across in a few minutes. Yeah. And the way we computed it was rather straightforward. Then we talked about the clustering coefficient, and that's pretty much where we left off. Okay. And we'll pick that up again. So the clustering coefficient is about transitivity, as we said yesterday, right? So if I'm connected to person A and connected to person B, the question is, in that network in question, is it more likely that A and B are also connected, or is this completely independent of the fact that they're both connected to me? And if this probability is higher, we would speak of, existing transitivity, and that would lead to a higher clustering of the graph. And how do we measure that? And there were two versions. The first version would set into proportion the number of triangles in the network versus the number of connected triples, right? And remember that. So a triangle naturally was something like this, and a connected triple would be something like this, okay? And since each triangle contains three connected triples, we would have to correct this by this number of three, so that for a perfectly transitive network, we'd have a clustering coefficient of one, okay? And a high number of triangles is, more or less naturally associated with dense subnetworks existing. Yeah. So just as a hint, we know that any clique, for example, is composed of triangles. Any clique is hierarchically composed of smaller cliques, and the triangle is naturally the smallest non-trivial clique, if you wish. Okay? And the two persons, Watts and Strogatz, would come up with a different version, and they said, okay, we'd have a local clustering coefficient, which is the number of triangles connected to some vertex in proportion to the number of triples centered on that vertex. Okay, and this was just an alternative version, and if we want to compute the clustering coefficient of the whole graph, we would just take the average of, the average of these local clustering coefficients. Okay, so this favors or weights some effects stronger than this version, but in essence, they both point in the same direction. So they're not fundamentally different, as I would say. Okay. And you can easily see that this local clustering coefficient, the number of triangles over the number of triples on with respect to some vertex I, is equal to that formula, okay? And where these nodes VK and VJ are in the neighborhood of NI over the possible pairs of nodes in the neighborhood of I, okay? And if these edges between K and J exists and both are in the neighborhood, then we'd have a triangle. If this triadic closure is really closed, right? And those are just the possible triples, just by doing combinatorics in my star-shaped friendship graph. Yeah. Good. And that's an important measure. And to give you an intuition of the difference between the two, just numerically, just by looking at an example. So the first clustering coefficient in that example graph would yield the following. So we clearly see that there is one triangle, right? This is the one triangle. And this is the correction factor of 3. And we'd have 8 of these triples, if you just count 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on. And if you count properly, you will get 8, right? And then this is the result, 0.375. And if you do the same thing with the local clustering coefficient, what you get is the CIs for each node, okay? So for the node C4, we'd get 0, as well as for the node C5, right? For this node, we get 1/6, okay? Because there is one triangle connected to that node, but there are 6 triples centered on that vertex, yeah? 1, 2, 3, 4, and I might have missed some, yeah? And it's 6 in total, okay, with this node as the center of the triple, okay? And this one, for example, has one triangle, but also one triple. So here we get a 1 as well as for that. And this is for the 1 over n, right? And in that case, we get a little bit higher value for the clustering coefficient of the whole graph. But in essence, it is the same. And what we're more interested in is the order of magnitude of these quantities. And I already mentioned that for certain classes of random graphs, we would get very low values for this transitivity, whereas for real social networks, we would get orders of magnitude higher values. And that's only natural because intuition tells us that we'd have a tendency towards triadic closure, right? If two friends of mine are friends of mine, then they have a higher probability of being friends also than just a random pair of nodes. Okay, that's only logical from a sociological point of view or from intuition. Okay, and so for many real-world networks, what we have is that the clustering coefficient is a constant if n goes to infinity. But for random networks, and we'll see a model of that, these coefficients go as 1 over n, which vanishes if we regard the limit of large graphs. Yeah? And that's a limit we always will focus on, okay? Because only in the limit of large graphs with the same architecture, same topology, you would get these effects, or you would be able to neglect perturbations that stem from local effects, right? If you go towards very large limits, then these local perturbative effects wouldn't play a role, okay? Wouldn't be interesting. Now, that's something that we would get back to, and that's just a table from Newman's survey paper. You might have a hard time reading the numbers, but, we could enlarge them if you want. So what is depicted is 4 classes of networks. Yes, social networks here, information networks, technological and biological networks. And this column tells us whether these networks are directed or undirected. Okay. And for example, you'd have this film actor network, which gave rise to the Kevin Bacon number, and so on and so on. There we'd have the number of nodes. Here, the number of edges, right? Z is the mean degree, yeah? And L is the mean average path length. Alpha is the coefficient of the power law in the degree distribution, if there is a power law at all. C1 is our first clustering coefficient, C2 our second, R, I'm not sure for the moment, yeah, but we'll check that, okay? Our degree correlation coefficient. So that is just the Pearson correlation of the degree of a node versus the degree of its neighbors, right? For each pair. And that's in order to classify whether the network is assortative or disassortative, which we will get to in a second, okay? And we see that those numbers, C1 and C2, are not fundamentally different. Well, they point in the same direction, as I would say. And comparing this, for example, to technological networks, where the clustering coefficient is 1 or 2 orders of magnitude smaller, we see that especially for the social networks, these things are comparatively large as claimed. Okay, good. And that's a table that'll be interesting for us for a couple of times. Okay, now, one very important thing that you'd come across in many, many papers, may it be about network technology or social networks or social computing, whatever, is the question of degree distribution. Yeah. So for a given K, what is the fraction of nodes that have a degree K? And that seems to be rather unspectacular. Okay, good, I'm counting the degrees, so what? Yeah. But this turns out to be very interesting. Now, what we can do is, in order to avoid some statistical problems, instead of this, these probability density or probability function here, we can have a cumulative distribution, which would account for the probability that we'd have a degree of K or larger. Okay, so the probability that some node has a degree of K or larger is given by summing from this K to infinity over this PK. Yeah, K prime, just to have a different summation index here, nothing else, okay? So that would be, well, a bit different from the usual cumulative probability distribution. Because normally in probability theory, what you have for the discrete, for the continuous case, you have some probability density function, yeah, and the cumulative distribution function or cumulative probability distribution, yeah, whatever you want to call this, CPD, would then be the integral, so that's P of x, and large P of x would be the integral from minus infinity to x, P of x prime dx prime. Yeah, so you would compute the surface under this curve from coming from minus infinity. Yeah, and the same would be true for a discrete probability distribution of some sort. Yeah, the only thing that's different here would be that you would sum from minus infinity to some x, P of x prime. Yeah. So x prime goes from minus infinity to x. That would be the discrete case, just summing all of them until a certain x, okay? And now what we do is a bit opposite, because what we now do is we have k, yeah, and we'd have the probabilities p of k, yeah, or pk. And what we sum is we start from some k and sum to infinity, sum all those values. Yeah, that's just for convenience, because we will see that we can handle certain things in a more convenient way. But it's nothing fundamentally different. Yeah? In both cases, you would have to integrate. Okay. So if you have a power law distribution, meaning that P of k is proportional to k to the minus alpha, which is this famous power law, then what we see is that the cumulative distribution, just by integrating a polynomial, you would have to add 1 to the exponent. And that's the usual procedure. If you integrate x squared, you would get 1/3 x to the power 3. Yeah, that's just the same. And so what we see is that the cumulative distribution is 1 more in the exponent than the probability distribution itself, whereas for exponential probability distributions, as we know, integrating an exponential function would just leave it invariant. The cumulative distribution has the same functional form. Yeah, and that's interesting if you plot these things and try to distinguish what's actually going on. Yeah, so if you plot your power law in a normal coordinate system, for example, for alpha equal to 2, what you get is such a curve. Yeah, that goes down and has a discontinuous region here at zero, so a singularity, sorry. And although it seems as if this going down here, if you go towards infinity, is pretty fast, it actually isn't. Yeah, so that's why we speak of long tail-like distributions that have a comparatively large contribution for very high k. Yeah, and if you regard an exponential decrease, you would get a much harsher decrease here towards plus infinity than for this polynomial decrease. Yeah, and for social networks, as you can imagine, there is some people that have in the order of magnitude, let's say, 500,000 friends, but somewhere this really ends. Yeah? So there is nobody that has 1 billion friends. Yeah? So there must be some exponential cutoff for large k's, even in the social case. Yeah? And if you draw this on a logarithmic scale, things just look like that. So that's just the y-axis depicted as logarithmic. Yeah, if you do a double logarithmic visualization, yeah, a double logarithmic plot, then you would see that naturally the power law corresponds to a straight line. And that's very characteristic. If you see straight line distributions, or that roughly look like straight lines, you can conclude qualitatively that you're having a power law. Whereas for the exponential case, if you have the singly logarithmic plot, you would have a straight line, but in the doubly logarithmic plot, you would have this arced curve here, right? Good. And these are examples from real world networks. So that is a collaboration network of mathematicians. This is a citation network, the web, the internet, a power grid, and protein-protein interactions. Okay, and we see that the web has a power law distribution, quite, yeah, classically so, whereas these collaboration networks kind of differ in their functional form. And for the citation networks as well, we might have a power law region here, but here and here we'd have certain deviations. Yeah? Whereas the internet as a technological network is here in this case also power law-like. Okay, and that's interesting because we will see that a very simple process leads to power laws. And the question is that network in question susceptible to these generative processes or not? Yeah. So that's why we are interested in these things. Now, an important notion is that power law networks, networks that have a degree distribution, that's power law, is are also called scale-free networks. Yeah? And scale-free, in a sense, means that whatever magnification you use to view these networks qualitatively, you would get the same topological picture, in a sense. Yeah. So roughly, very roughly comparable to fractals, right? Because a fractal just looks the same no matter how far you zoom in or zoom out. Okay. But that's only very roughly comparable. So why are they called scale-free? Well, so this power law, this polynomial, is the only solution to the functional equation kind of defining what we mean by scale-free. Yeah. So the f of a times x, where a is a factor that changes the scale of measurement, would just be a constant times this f of x back. Yeah? So f would still look the same no matter what scale you use inside, right? Another point of view is that while we can actually compute the expectation of such a power law, at least if alpha is larger than 1, otherwise it would not be integratable or the sum would diverge. The variance, however, the variance would diverge. Okay, so if you associate variance with something like an error bar, if you have ever made measurements in physics or so, you just cannot say what the true error is. So in a sense, we cannot be sure about that. So this might be interpreted as there is no characteristic scale, which then gives rise to the term scale-free. Maybe this is the more straightforward definition for scale freedom. Okay, so that's an important term. If you read something about scale-free networks, you know that it's associated with a power law degree-like distribution. Okay, examples, okay. Typical power law networks, okay, citation networks, the web, the internet, metabolic pathways, these large posters that life scientists hang up in their laboratories, telephone call networks, that is something that Barabashi has, for example, investigated a lot, these sexual networks and so on. exponential degree distributions, power grids, railway networks, whereas power laws, modified power laws, so those that have exponential cutoffs for large degrees, actually exist for the movie coactor network. And in all these modified networks, you would have some mechanism kind of limiting the possibility to have large degrees. In the social friendship case, it's clear, because it is often cited that people have a social scope that they can really serve of about 100 or 200 friends, true friends, which is very high indeed, okay? And or a very high estimate already. And whereas people that have 10,000 Facebook friends are surely not able to know each one of them. And for the movie co-actor network, it's also clear because, well, movies have their rhythms. Movies take their time. Yeah, they have a normal format. They take their time to shoot. And naturally, people have an acting span of, let's say, from 15 to 80. So that naturally limits their amount of co-acting. Yeah, good. Okay, good. Another thing is that we might be interested in is trying to investigate the actual maximum degree that's in the network. Okay, so one way of kind of formalizing this is saying the maximum degree occurs if less or equal than one vertex has this maximum degree on average, which means that n times this PK max should be one. Yeah? So that's just a notion. That's just a way to formalize what we mean with maximum, might mean with maximum degree. Whereas the straightforward definition naturally is the highest degree that's out there. Okay. Now for a power law, what we see is that this K max should go as 1 over n to the 1 over alpha. Yeah, that's just in order to satisfy this equation. However, that's not very accurate. Other ways are, okay, so the probability of the event, exactly m nodes with degree K exist, and the rest of the nodes has a smaller degree than K. This is given by this polynomial, binomial-like expression. Yeah, so PK is the probability or the fraction of nodes having degree K, and PK, large PK, is the probability that the degree of a node in question is K or larger. Yeah, so we sum that up here to infinity, right? So if we want to have exactly M nodes with K and the rest is smaller, we cannot have larger degrees. So that's why we'd have 1 minus this one. Yeah. And we'd have this binomial coefficient in order to account for the combinatorics, these, how they are selected among those N nodes, right? And the probability expression is clear. Okay. So the probability of K actually being the highest degree in the graph, in order to come up with the probability for this event, we'd have to sum over all M, right? Because, yeah, well, this is just a free quantity. And if we sum over that, what we get is this particular result, okay? And the expected highest degree in the network is just the expectation of this quantity, right? So sum over k times the probability hk. Yeah. And you might just compute and be satisfied with that. Yeah. But what we see is that this distribution here, hk, is rather peaked. It's rather peaked around K max, okay? So hk is small for small k and also small for large k. So what we can do is we can estimate the expectation by not summing as down here, yeah, but instead of computing the maximum value of hk, or not the maximum itself, but the argument k, where hk is maximal. So what we do is we replace the expectation with a modal estimate. Yeah? And the modal estimate would then just be the extremum of hk. Yeah? So we know that the derivation of the cumulative probability density function would just give the normal density function. That's just how it's built, right? And if we compute the derivation d to the dk of hk and insert our formula for hk that we won or computed, this is just the result, okay? And if you simplify this expression, what you see is that this k max then is a solution of this, well, differential equation, if you want, okay? And if you do further approximations, so if you say that pk is small for k's that are larger than that, and also small for k's that are smaller, and if you assume that this quantity can in some sense be neglected or is of order one or less, and that pk is also smaller than one, for a power law, we would then get that k max is proportional to 1 over n to the power 1 over alpha minus 1. And that's just not very different from this simple estimation. So in many cases, you would not be very far off if you use these simple estimations instead of a more complicated, yeah, thorough evaluation, okay? So, good. And that's just to grasp what these degree distributions are, what they look like, and how we can deal with them. Now, another quantity that we might be interested in is the network resilience. So what do we mean by that? So resilience formalizes the stability of the network with respect to taking away edges or nodes, okay? And if nodes or edges are removed, we can have the effect that the network would still function in a sense. And with function in a communication network, we mean that there is still enough possible connections from one node to another. And in a social network, also there's enough friendship chains to let some information pass from one friend to another. Okay. Now, there were two basic ideas of how to attack a network. The first idea is we could attack a network by randomly taking away nodes or edges, which is structurally not very different for that moment being. And this strategy of randomly taking away nodes would yield the result that's depicted by this blue series of points, right? And in the diagram, we'd have on the x-axis the fraction of vertices that we removed, yeah? And on the y-axis, we'd have the effect on the mean vertex distance, so the mean vertex-vertex distance or mean average path length in a certain sense. And we see that power law networks, as it is the case here, are very, very resilient towards this random removal strategy. And that's why the internet actually keeps on working when some of the servers just go down, right? So it's not too much of an issue, right? The converse strategy is if you concentrate your attack on the highest degree nodes, then the effect is rather dramatic, right? So if you start from the highest degree and keep on removing further those that have also high degrees and so on and so on, then the result is the red curve, right? So it is a dramatic effect with respect to connectivity. And if you continue to do that, then you would end up with disconnected components. Yeah. And the interpretations are, in a sense, a bit controversial at first glance, because you might say, okay, the internet is easy to attack. The only thing is I have to shoot down servers with a high number of connections, right? The other interpretation that was given in a paper and was cited by Newman in his survey article is that if you, it is in a sense hard to detect them, and in another sense there are only comparatively few of these present in a certain sense. So, it is also possible to interpret that fact in the way that the internet is actually pretty stable, right? However, these network resilience effects are interesting. And one thing that we might be interested in is there still one component, basically, in the network, or does the network fall apart into several components? That's something we're interested in, and we'll see that this giant component and its existence is another good example for such a measure, coming up in a second. Before that, we would talk about a fourth, are we at the fourth, maybe at the fifth already, quantity that we might be interested in, and that's just the mixing behavior, or the mixing pattern, I should say, behavior kind of induces something dynamical, and we would just look at the network as it is, the mixing pattern in the network. And we would have two basic patterns. We'd have assortative mixing, meaning that nodes typically attach to nodes that are similar to them or are attached, right? And disassortative mixing means that nodes are attached to nodes that are different in some sense. Yeah? And assortative mixing is also sometimes called homophily, whereas disassortative mixing is called heterophily. Okay. What can these properties be? So we can talk about the degree. We can talk about profile parameters such as age or race and so on. It can be a lot of things, yeah? But the effect, or the pattern would still be the same, either similar or different, right? And examples for assortativity are clearly social networks, right? If you regard the party example from last time, it would always be the case that these super high socializers would want to stay among themselves. So super socializers would connect to super socializers, whereas bystanders would connect to bystanders. Okay? That's the same. It is also true for money. Rich people connect to rich people, poor to poor. It is true for race. It is true for age. It is true for almost all the properties that you can imagine. Yeah. Whereas food webs are disassortative. Yeah. So plants are, so if you have a food web formalizing who eats who, then certainly a plant is eaten by a herbivore, and the herbivore is eaten by a carnivore, but it's very seldomly the case that a herbivore eats another herbivore, right? So I don't know if anybody has ever observed a cow eating another cow, yeah, or a plant eating another plant. I mean, there are cases in a sense. So there is certainly lions killing hyenas, And if food is really scarce, they might even eat them. Yeah, but this is scarcely the case. Yeah, the internet is also disassortatively mixed. Yeah, so we'd have these very large backbone providers that are then connected to internet service providers, which in turn are connected to end users, whereas a typical end user would not be connected to other end users. Yeah, and an ISP would not very be highly connected to other ISPs. Yeah, so that's more like a tree-like structure. Good. And the question is, can we come up with a mathematical quantity, such as in transitivity, right? And one example is based on an idea that's very close to modularity that we came across, right? So here what we see is a marriage network and its properties, right? So what we see is that we clearly have an assortative mixing. Black people tend to marry black people, whereas Hispanic people also tend to marry Hispanic people. And there's a little mixing in there, sadly enough, okay? But what we also see is that this matrix here is not symmetric, because men and women are on the respective axis. So men is on the y-axis and women are on the x-axis, if you want. And so if you look at the things from a male perspective, so if you have a Hispanic male, you are less likely to marry a black woman, whereas a Hispanic woman is more likely to be linked to a black man, right? So this is not a symmetric matrix, okay? If you remember when we talked about modularity, we had the same things, okay? So these represented clusters, and the entries in the matrix was just the number of connections from a cluster to other clusters or to itself. So that's exactly this matrix E that we had when we talked about modularity. If you normalize your large E matrix with all the sum of all the entries, then you get your small E matrix, which is just a fraction of connections that are of the respective nature, right? So in that sense, you can have the probability that J is of that we have sort J, given that the other node is of sort I, we would have exactly this expression as in modularity before, right? And the sum of EIJ is naturally 1, and summing over the J's only, we would also be required to get 1, okay? So that's just the probability that we're interested in. And using this, we can have two measures of assortativity. So the first measure was suggested by some authors, cited by Newman. And this is just the probability of sort I connecting to sort I, normalized over the total N. Yeah, and these minus ones are just minor corrections. And for a perfectly assortative network, you would only have entries here on the diagonal, whereas the off-diagonal elements would just be 0, right? So assortativity for such a perfectly assortative network would be 1, or the measure for assortativity. Now, the drawback is that since in the computation for PJI, you would have this matrix element EIJ, and you would have to sum over the columns. You would not only have the diagonal element here included in this computation, but also off-diagonal element. But the question is, since we sum over the columns in a row, we would have a male perspective in a sense, yeah? But the question is, why wouldn't we have a female perspective and put the women here on the y-axis? This would yield different values for PII, and it would yield different values for Q. So we don't know which one is actually true in a sense. So both are as valid as the other. And what you could do is take the average, for example, of both, yeah, which would, in my eyes, be also okay. However, a second measure of assortativity would just be modularity itself, normalized with 1 over minus e squared, okay? So trace e minus e squared is exactly the expression for modularity, okay? And it measures, in a sense, the intra-cluster coherence, and that's nothing else but assortativity in a certain sense, if you normalize this in that fashion. Yeah, so what we learn is modularity is also a measure for assortativity, right? And these terms, assortative mixing and disassortative mixing, or homophily and heterophily, are also very common in the literature and thus required for understanding, okay? Good. One special example that's worth another slide is if this similarity is measured with respect to degree. Okay, so do nodes attach to nodes with the same or different degree? Yeah, and you can have several ways to measure this. So one way is to kind of visualize the mean degree of the neighbors of nodes with degree k. Yeah, so you would have a curve where you would have k on the x-axis and the mean degree of the neighbors on the y-axis, okay? And if we have assortative mixing, we should have somehow an increasing curve, yeah? So high k should correspond to high mean degree and low k to low mean degree, yeah? So for the internet, for example, we see a decreasing curve for that statistic, so we can conclude that the internet is disassortatively mixed. But that's just putting the statistics in one curve, right? What you can also do is you can put this into one number only. And that's just what happens in our table in the second to next column from seen from the right side here, this nice table that we looked at. So this is the Pearson correlation between the numbers k of the degree of a node in question and the number of degrees of one of its neighbors, right? So for any pair of nodes, you would record these two numbers, k and the k of the other node. And naturally, Pearson correlation is just, well, the diagonal elements of the covariance matrix. And we know that if both series of numbers are similar in that sense, the correlation would be 1 in the ideal case. And if there is no linear correlation, the Pearson correlation would yield 0. Okay, so Pearson correlation is, let's denote it by R, is in minus 1 to 1, yeah? And 0 indicates no correlation, and minus 1 is a perfectly negative correlation. So if the one is higher, the other one is lower. And plus 1 is a perfectly positive correlation. However, Pearson correlation just measures linear correlations. Okay? So if we'd have numbers A and B, and we would only regard pairs of those, and those pairs are somehow like this, then we know we can draw or we can interpolate this with a straight line, and the linear correlation is, well, high, nearer to 1, okay? However, Pearson itself doesn't account for nonlinear correlations. Yeah. So if you have a perfect correlation that is something like B is A squared, yeah, then the linear correlation would not be high. Yeah. This can be like corrected by switching from Pearson correlation to Spearman correlation or other correlation measures. And in that way, you can have a single number for the whole graph, kind of formalizing its mixing pattern or its assortativity, right? And that's once again this this table where we would have these numbers. And we see since they're all positive for social networks, we can speak of assortative mixing. However, you should be cautious in terms of interpreting Pearson correlations. Yeah? So there is a wild practice in papers. So if you really want to find an effect, a correlation effect, people would also say, well, that 0.120 is a positive correlation. But as far as I'm informed, usually you would speak of a strong or fundamental correlation only if the Pearson correlation is greater than 0.5. And a mild correlation would be accepted normally if it's between 0.3 and 0.5, at least orders of magnitude, right? And 0.120 would, in more conservative statistical circles, not be accepted as a true positive correlation. However, what you can do is also compute Spearman's R and others and see whether there is at least some nonlinear correlation effects, right? But nevertheless, these quantities are quite large, okay, and they're positive. Whereas for the technological networks, they're also at least sometimes quite large and negative. And so we can conclude that these are rather disassortative. Yeah? But still, the linear correlation in that case, for example, for the power grid is almost zero. Yeah. So at least we cannot speak of a linear correlation here. We might have some others, yeah, but that would be subject to computing these. Okay. Another thing that's interesting and that's mentioned in Newman's article is the community or group structure of these large networks. So what we see here is a friendship graph in a U.S. American school, high school, and the black nodes are depicted by the color black. How ingenious. However, the authors fail to let the edges be depicted by another color. That's a little bit of a visualization fail in a certain sense, because you just cannot distinguish between the black nodes and the black edges. Okay. However, what we see is that whites tend to stay among themselves and blacks also tend to stay among themselves. However, a note of caution with respect to these visualizations. Now, this is a typical example of a force-based visualization algorithm. And as I said, the mechanics of these algorithms is always the same. So you would assume a force between two nodes that's proportional to the weight of the respective edge. Okay. Can also be a weight of one for if you only have friendships or not. That doesn't matter in a sense. Yeah. And you, what you would normally imagine is that these are forces of an elastic spring. And you can imagine that if the spring has a positive spring constant that is very large, so it's a very strong spring, then it's very hard to tear apart these two nodes or to put them closer to each other. So they are, in a sense, fixed. Yeah? And you would have this between any nodes that are connected by an edge. And then you could imagine like squeezing this whole system of springs together, throwing it in the air, and then some equilibrium will result. And in that equilibrium, typically nodes that have a strong relation to each other are close in the visualization. Yeah, and that's very convenient because in these Spring embedded visualizations, you can leave out the edges because the spatial proximity already indicates that there should be a connection of high weight between two nodes, right? However, these things are notoriously unstable. Yeah, so you might, if you really compute this, you would use an iterative algorithm where you wouldn't solve the true physics equations, but have a rather naive approach of following or changing the actual location of a node in the visualization in the direction of the force. Okay. And if you do that iteratively, you can converge to different solutions. Yeah. And in some sense, they can be misleading sometimes. Yeah. You remember that I gave you an example in the beginning of that lecture. So if we have, let's say, a triangle, and we visualize it as such, yeah, this is, if we don't have any weights on the edges, the same graph drawing would perfectly be valid that looks like this, yeah, because, well, the length doesn't account for something topologically, right? But this one kind of has a completely different intuition for your eye than this one, whereas mathematically it's the same graph. Yeah. So we must be cautious about using our eye as a detector for structures, because we can only do so on the basis of a visualization, and the visualization would always be somehow non-canonical. There's N ways to visualize a large network. Yeah. And it's a whole science. There's a whole series of conferences on graph drawings, and this is an art form. So if it is computed by a Spring embedder algorithm, we can somehow rely on the intuition that nodes that are close are all physically, geometrically close, are also close in terms of weights and path lengths and so on. But as I said, we have to be cautious. Well, this seems to kind of suggest that blacks would befriend blacks and whites would befriend whites, okay? So luckily enough, we don't have to dig any further into that topic because we already covered that topic. We talked a lot about graph clustering, modularity-based community detection, dense subnetworks, and so on. So we're already experts with respect to the group structure, right? Another thing is about the navigatability of the network, okay? So remember what I told you about the Milgram experiment. Yeah, that was the one where people in the U.S. were sent kits, experimental kits, requiring them to kind of forward some letter to an unknown person at the East Coast. Yeah, and the kits contained postcards and so on that would allow Milgram and his co-experimenters to monitor the progress of their messages, right? And then they would be able to record via respective bookkeeping in the message sheets itself, I presume, the number of hops that this message took, right? So that was roughly the Milgram experiment. And that's one of the first experiments that gave rise to this notion of small worlds, yeah? Because the average amount of hops was very small. However, the question that there is some sort of short path doesn't necessarily mean that people can also use this to navigate, right? So the person starting the letter, yeah, has no real clue, in a sense, of actually how to get there. It just forwards the letter to the person he or she thinks is somehow closer to the target. And closer can mean a lot of things. It can mean geographical closeness. It can mean closeness in terms of occupation. It can mean a lot of things. And the question is, if there are short paths, can people use some metric to actually find them? And that's a non-trivial issue. In a sense, the Milgram experiment has this finding built in a certain sense, but other networks might not. Yeah, so the question is a network actually navigatable? Is something that we will dig into more depth in the next chapter when we look at social networks in time and space. There are some interesting effects that we will come across. So, for example, what is the probability that I'm a friend of a person at distance R? Yeah, and we'll see that this falls off as a power law. Okay, cool. Good. And so that was that. And I guess the last or next to last quantity that we're interested in is the component structure of the graph. Okay. Now, basically, one of the central questions is there a giant component or not? And what do we mean by giant component? A giant component is a component that encompasses almost all the nodes. So in other words, is the graph connected or not? And what we will see next time is that for social networks and for a whole class of other networks, the giant component almost always exists. Yeah. So if you have a social network, usually you would not have to make up your mind about disconnected components. Yeah. Just filter out the very small ones, and you can be sure that the rest would be only one component. Okay. And that might kind of matter if you would use statistics on path lengths or so, because we know that in disconnected, if you regard paths between disconnected component nodes in disconnected components, then these lengths would be infinite, right? But what we will see is that these components always exist. What we will also see next time is that this is a typical example for something that we might call a non-continuous behavior, right? So in graphs, we have things like phase transitions. And phase transitions, for those that know statistical physics, are a very interesting collective phenomenon of statistical systems that are governed by some microscopic laws. Okay. So, for example, one phase transition occurs when ice melts. So it's a phase transition from the liquid to the solid state. And we know that the solid state has completely different properties than the liquid state. And there's a precise point where this phase transition occurs. And this precise point has to do with the micro laws governing the actual molecules. Yeah. So the geometry of the molecules, their electronic properties, and so on. Right. And that's also true for graphs. Yeah. So we have certain properties, for example, as a function of the mean degree, that are not present. And then they certainly become very fundamentally present. Yeah. So there is something like a non-continuous phenomena type of thing going on there. And that's what physicists doing network analysis are very interested in, and what they keep on treating with their field theoretic methods that I also have forgotten, if in case I ever knew them from my physics course of study, right? But we're not going to go too deep into that. Just one example about the giant component. Good. So the time's over, so see you next week. However, regard that next Tuesday there is no lecture because of ICOM. Yeah, and in this lecture hall there will be Zetsche and the other guys talking, Siemens CEOs and so on. So I was inclined to give it away, this slot. So we would have, we would move this to the Wednesday slot. Okay. So for the brave ones that are fighting with their sleep, unfortunately it will be Wednesday again, due to ICOM, right? So next Tuesday, no lecture. So see you on Wednesday then. See you.